Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad when you join us here. And if you'd like to take part in our conversations, you're more than welcome to do so at these phone numbers, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. And by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We get a lot of information from our bodies, especially our various bodily fluids. That's why doctors often ask for blood samples or urine samples, and not just medical doctors. A research request recently went out to households in Josephine County asking for recipients to send in urine samples. Such a widespread request is a little unusual. And the request drew even more attention because of who it came from. Art Robinson is the scientist asking for the samples. He's also the chair of the Oregon Republican Party, and he talks to us this morning from his base at the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine at his home in Cave Junction. Art Robinson, thank you for joining us once again.
Well, thanks for having me on.
The Institute itself, I mean, I suppose most folks would want to know why you set up shop so far from the beaten path in Cave Junction.
Well, my wife and I and some of our colleagues decided to do this 33 years ago. We've been here 33 years, and we do research in biochemistry and in developing new methods for the clinical laboratory. That's the thing you're talking about. We've been doing this, actually, we've been doing research of this sort for 50 years, all my life, but 33 years here. We have a nice little research laboratory and do good work.
And what's the general thrust of the work then? I mean, what kinds of things are you looking to find out from the work you do?
Well, we work in two areas. One is fundamental biochemistry, and we work on little molecular clocks that are built into protein molecules. This is the basic research we do. The work that you're referring to that's entertaining people a little is work to try to learn more, basically to measure health quantitatively by measurements on body fluids. The field is called metabolic profiling or metabolomics, and my colleagues and I founded this field in the 70s. In those days, the technology enabled you to measure about 200 chemical substances in a breath sample or a urine sample. And it was our hypothesis that by measuring these and looking at the patterns, the complete patterns in all of the substances, these are substances mostly made by your body, either because your enzymes will make them because you need the substances or they're byproducts of their activity. And our hypothesis we developed in the early 70s was that patterns were contained in them that would be superior for measuring human health, figuring out in the case of a degenerative disease, one that develops over a long period of time. Perhaps you could see the diseases before the symptoms were evident, and that, of course, is an advantage, and superior in diagnosing and monitoring therapy and so on. As you know, when you go to the doctor's office, he may measure a half dozen things in a urine sample and perhaps 30 things in a blood sample. That's been traditional for almost a century. So we worked on this, and we proved that it did work. We were able to diagnose cancer, breast cancer, multiple sclerosis, muscular dystrophy, things of this sort, long ago by these techniques. But the techniques were impractical. To do it, we had to build an extraordinary analytical laboratory, the best in the world, and there was no way that that could be offered to people. It was very expensive and very slow. Over the last few decades, however, analytical technology has advanced tremendously. And now, in a few seconds, it's possible to measure several thousand things in a urine or breath sample. And I've been advocating for a long time in my writing and other ways that this should become mainstream medicine. But the thing that stops it is not the analytical technology now, it's the calibration. In order to use usefully these patterns, they must be measured in large numbers of people, and we have to learn empirically, because you don't understand these things. The biochemistry is too complex. There are too many substances. But empirically, you, for example, get, if you can obtain 30 or 40 samples from people who, from women who have breast cancer, and 30, 40 samples from people, or women, who ultimately got it later after your samples, and then from controls, you can develop patterns that can see the disease before they know it, before the overt symptoms develop. That's preventive medicine. And also, by collecting samples from ordinary people, there are a lot of different aspects to this. For example, if you collect samples on a person and then they become ill, you can use their previous samples as the control. And using them as their own baseline, you can contain a lot more information. In any case, there are a lot of aspects of it. Quantitative measurement of physiological age is easy. You can find out what their physiological age is biochemically, and that enables you to track the rate of aging, which is really the rate by which they become susceptible to fatal diseases. So there's a lot of potential in it, but the main drawback in this field over the last few decades has been lots of papers have been published, but no one has calibrated it by building a bank of samples to calibrate it so the public, so that the doctors and the medical establishment could truly use it in medicine. And that's what we're trying to do, and it's expensive. You have to build a cryogenic facility to do it. We've been aiming toward this goal for about 10 years, and we finally got that facility built, and we're ready to do the job. Interestingly, but sort of amusingly, it intersected with this political activity. That was an accident. It had nothing to do with the politics, of course. But
so it was going to happen anyway, and then you just happened to be
named Oregon Republican
Chair.
It was going to happen anyway. Yeah. I've been our institute is supported entirely by private donations from there are about 1,000 people and small foundations that help us, and I've been telling them for years we want to do this, and finally, we got together the money to build the facility necessary, and actually, the only way that our appeal to the public and to doctors are helping us too, the only way that our appeal was and it was affected by politics is it was slowed down a little bit. You'd have probably seen those flyers earlier if we hadn't been trying to do this other work.
Art Robinson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He runs the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine in Cave Junction and is also the chair of the Oregon Republican Party. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to separate the possibles from the have already happens here. You mentioned that urine can be used to detect things like breast cancer. So are you saying this already works in advance of other techniques for detecting disease?
These are the most advanced methods of detecting disease. But, you know, science advances in a progression. The tools you have to detect disease when you go to the doctor, the tools he has, they're the result of research that was done, in many cases, 60, 70, 80 years ago. And as the research is done and as the papers are published, and the only output from our work are research papers. They go into the open literature, into the journals, and people read them, and other scientists work on it. And then gradually, if the research becomes good enough or useful enough, why, industry applies them and the doctors have them. But this field has advanced a lot, but it's been advancing in the research world. And it's clearly the most advanced way to detect disease. But that doesn't mean that it's in the doctor's office yet. After it is sufficiently advanced and sufficiently calibrated, then the medical industry would pick it up and start to apply it. And we, of course, aren't involved in that. We just do research.
So how many requests for samples went out? Was it pretty much every household in Josephine County?
Say it again?
How many requests for samples went out?
We have a little over 400 from the mailing we did, which is quite good as far as I'm concerned, because we know that from the response we got from our flyer that we can do the project and get all the samples we need. This was a sort of pilot project in Josephine County. So the first result was to get 400 volunteers, and that I was very pleased with that result because I know that we can get, by future mailings, the volunteers we need.
So 400 samples came back.
Well, I don't know how many have come back. I know how many volunteered, and they are
okay.
We send them the collection things, and then they come back. And I know a lot have come back, but I just got back from a trip, and I know that people are still volunteering. So we have 300 back. I don't know how many have given the sample yet.
All right, but it's a two-part process. Then first they agree to be volunteers, and then you send them the kit.
That's right. Then we send them a collection kit, and this is the first phase. Eventually, after we have established the complete volunteer base, we'll put little collection centers in two or three places around the county. This is urine. Breath we aren't collecting right now. It's more difficult, but we will in the future. The research shows that it's an excellent fluid to look at, too. The samples, by the time the urine is produced by your body and collected and you dispose of it in the usual way, it has been at above or at room temperature for a little while. When a sample is taken and mailed, that increases that exposure to room temperature by about threefold. And the substances, since we look at several thousand substances, probably, and we've done this both ways, perhaps 5 or 10% of those substances are degrading with time because you aren't storing it frozen. So we know that these samples will be very valuable, probably we'll be able to do all the work we need with them, but we would prefer that the samples be cold immediately. So eventually they'll build collection centers and you put them in a freezer there and that freezes them cryogenically immediately. When they get here, they're frozen cryogenically. They have to be kept at minus 80 degrees centigrade because over the long period of time that the bank is built up, why they have to be frozen so that there's no chemical degradation.
So, Art Robinson, I'm sure anybody who would consider donating a urine specimen would have two questions. Number one, what's in it for me? And number two, is there any ID tracking back to me?
We're very careful to make sure our records are, of course, never hooked to any computer that's connected to the Internet and are extremely carefully guarded here. We know today that computer records, and of course we have to computerize these files, the computer records are, I mean, if you put them on the Internet, nothing is safe. We never connect any research records, not just these, but any of our research records to networks where people could take them. Anything can happen. I mean, someone can burglarize your place and steal your computers. You can always create a scenario whereby a record would become known, but we have the best security we can create to protect the privacy of the people that help us.
And do they get anything in return? Do they get a dollar or something, or just
they don't get anything in return. We have explained to them in the flyer that this is research, and the only thing they get is the satisfaction of knowing they helped with some valuable research. We are not in the business of practicing medicine, and the laws are such that if we were to start to provide people with information about themselves on the basis of the urine they send us, then we'd be violating the law. We don't do that.
All right. Well, certainly your lab work and your political work are separate, but, you know, you are, in fact, Art Robinson. You're a national figure now, so you must have thought at the start of the project that there would be some viewing of the urine sample requests through the lens of your recent naming as head of the Oregon Republican Party.
Well, I don't think that I don't think we're getting volunteers because of that. I hope we're not losing them because of it. But I think that the only link is a little entertaining. It's an odd thing to have happen. But you see, especially in the Republican Party, perhaps you're interviewing me on this. I shouldn't talk about politics. But the people
we can do both. It's no problem.
Yeah. People are productive, and a lot of the people in our party are productive. They do all kinds of useful things, and we don't stop doing the useful things that are our life's work just because we are active in politics. Sure, it's a little amusing. You could put it a different way. The losing congressional candidate from last year decided to ask the voters for urine samples. I mean,
You put it that way first. I never heard anybody else put it that way.
I think it's amusing. I think it's a little entertaining. It did not have, the two were totally unlinked. I mean, you can read my writings and the things I tell our contributors and so forth. I've been trying to build this up for years. But the juxtaposition is a source of entertainment. I hope we haven't lost potential donors because of the political activity we had, and I doubt that we've gained many because of that.
Have you had any conversations, Art Robinson, with other members of the GOP Central Committee about this work?
Yeah. We all know about it. I don't think we've had a single conversation about it. Nobody's brought it up.
Really? Okay.
They know about it.
I was just curious on a scale of, hey, that's great, to, geez, Art, you know, where the conversation
well,
was going.
Look, if we go through the Central Committee, we'll find all kinds of people that have interesting occupations. And that is not usually. We've had quite a few meetings of the political leadership, and several since this. They know about it, but nobody has. Nobody's broached it as an issue of any kind.
So let's compare and contrast your two jobs then. I mean, basically, which is easier, which is harder? I mean, finding clues to human disease or rebuilding and refunding the American Republican Party?
I love my research work. That's my whole life. And the political work is very difficult and complicated. And as you know, the political environment in our country is pretty complicated now. I find the research work 100 times more rewarding than the other. The other is a public service. I have no interest in a political career, and I'm like quite a few other people now that are coming out of the woodwork that are looking at the country and our state and our nation and saying, this doesn't look good to us, and we should do a little public service to try to do our part in improving things. That's public service, and it's not. It's enjoyable because you meet large numbers of wonderful people and work with them. It's enjoyable as a personal activity, but as a professional activity, it's not a professional activity. It's just a little public service. You know, I advocate that our offices in the legislature and in Congress should be filled by citizen volunteers and not career politicians. And we're seeing more and more citizen volunteers as people in our country become alarmed by the many problems that we have. We each of us describes the problems in different ways. Those on one side of the political spectrum see them one way, on the other side they see them another, but we're all alarmed on both sides. And you're seeing more and more, I think, sort of, you could call it amateur, or you could call it citizen volunteer activity in the political spectrum because of this alarm, and we're just a part of that.
All right, Robinson's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He is the chair of the Oregon Republican Party and the head of the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine. So we're kind of mixing topics here, but we're talking about his work with urine samples from across Josephine County and his work with the Oregon Republicans. A few minutes left here at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Art, when you talk about getting more amateurs involved in government, and I don't mean that in any sort of pejorative way. I just wonder if that's part of the issue, though, with how strongly things get expressed, that unlike professional politicians, the right honorable gentleman stuff is just sort of not there.
Yeah, well, I certainly don't mean to degrade my efforts or my colleagues' efforts by the word amateur, but, you know, in the first century, talking about federal office, we can talk about any of these playing fields, but in federal office, during the first century of our country, a congressman, on average, served just over 2 years. Now, there were no career politicians. And I think that our country was constructed more with that in mind. The average tenure of a congressman today is 12 years, and some serve twice that. I think that we are better off when our country is served by people who have accomplished things. And my view of a great congressional candidate, and I don't mean to refer or even state house candidate. I'm not referring to myself or somebody else.
Because you did run for
Congress.
But
I have a job now. My job is to find good candidates. And my idea of a great candidate to serve our state or our nation is someone who's so respected in his community that he's sort of a pillar of the community, somebody the community looks to when there's some problem occurs, someone who has been very successful and is admired and considered honest you know what I mean, people who have been especially outstanding in their professions and their contributions to their community, who are then the people in the community go to them and say, it's your time, your turn, you have to serve in the legislature or in the Congress for a couple of years because people of your kind are the ones that we want to represent us. I look at that as the ideal candidate, not someone who's been in politics for 10 years and is trying to figure out what the next step in his career will be.
So in the landscape, it's obviously changed a bit since you first ran for Congress with the Citizens United decision. Money in politics different from what it was back then. I mean, is this a real opportunity for the Oregon Republicans to beef up the bank account, do more outreach to potential candidates?
No, I don't think so. You know, the it would take us hours to discuss the ins and outs of all the campaign finance. There are all kinds of campaign finance things that favor the incumbents. There may be some little advances that are favoring the challengers. In my view, the whole field of campaign finance, wherein the incumbents are almost entirely financed by contributions from the special interests that they've done favors for in government, that is a problem. People worry about corporate contributions. I understand that's a problem. I think the whole campaign finance environment is not good. And I don't like the financial playing field that we have in politics today, but I'm powerless to change it. I'm trying to do some good for my state and nation, and I can only do it on the playing field that's there. And the financial aspects of that playing field are not good.
So back to the other topic in hand here. Actually, let me see if I can fit in a call here. Bill and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Art Robinson.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. He got political, so I have a couple of political questions to him.
It's got to be quick. We got about a minute.
Okay. Did you ever sell a homeschool teaching system where people would be homeschooled? And did you ever publicly publish in a newsletter or speak against public education and wanting to do away with it?
All right, Bill, thanks.
We do sell a homeschool curriculum. And I have, in Washington, D.C., the average African-American student graduates from high school illiterate. Two-thirds of them can't read. And I have made very strong statements about those aspects of our educational system. I think it is tragic that in many cases, especially in the minority communities, we have schools that are totally failing the students and cutting them off at the knees for life.
Okay, Art Robinson,
we're teaching them basic skills.
We're out of
time.
And
in those contexts, I have made very strong statements.
Thank you so much for joining us, Art Robinson, on the Jefferson Exchange.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 30th of September, 2013. It's the birthday of Truman Capote, born in New Orleans in 1924, moved with his mother to New York City as a child. They applied to the prestigious Trinity School, where young Truman was given an IQ test, and he scored 215, the highest in the school's history. It's the birthday of the poet W.S. Merwin, born New York City on this day, 1927, raised in Union City, New Jersey. His father was a Presbyterian minister, studied at Princeton, literature, romance languages, and went about translating poetry from French and Spanish and Italian, also Portuguese and Latin, also Yiddish, Japanese, and Sanskrit. His collected poems of W.S. Merwin came out in May of this year. W.S. Merwin, who said, "I think there's a kind of desperate hope built into poetry now that one really wants hopelessly to save the world. One is trying to say everything that can be said for the things that one loves while there's still time." And it was on this date in 1791, Mozart's The Magic Flute premiered in Vienna at the Freihaus Theater, about a 20-minute walk from Mozart's apartment. The Magic Flute, not exactly an opera, a singspiel with some spoken dialogue, and written in German, a language once considered too lowbrow for a serious opera. Mozart had been approached by Emanuel Schikaneder, who ran the opera troupe, asking him to compose the music, and Schikaneder wrote the libretto. Not a great libretto, certain chaos in it and contradictory plot elements, some slapstick comedy, some allegory. But Mozart was a Freemason, as was Schikaneder, and the libretto is full of Masonic symbolism. And so he set to work, Mozart, and he finished the overture, just 2 days before the premiere. Mozart's sister-in-law, Josefa Hofer, played the role of the Queen of the Night. She was a very good singer, and so Mozart wrote more challenging music for her than for other roles which would be filled by lesser singers. Mozart was very fond of the magic flute and went to nearly every performance of it until his death, just about 2 months after the premiere. Today, it's one of the three most performed operas in the world. Here's a poem for today by W.S. Merwin, Dog Dreaming. The paws twitch in a place of chasing, where the whimper of the seeming gentle creature rings out terrible, chasing tigers. The fields are licking like torches, full of running, laced odors, bones stalking, tushed leaps, so little that is tamed, yet so much that you would find deeply familiar there. You are there often. Your very eyes, the unfathomable knowledge behind your face, the mystery of your will, appraising such carnage and triumph, standing there, strange even to yourself, and loved, and only a sleeping beast knows who you are. Dog Dreaming by W.S. Merwin, from his collection Green with Beasts, published by Alfred A. Knopf, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by LendingTree, where you can fill out one form and receive up to 5 loan offers at trylendingtree.com, NMLS 1136. And by Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily online workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and are dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. More at Lumosity.com. Produced by Joy Biles with assistance from Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.